According to David Anthony, Grand Funk Railroad played at a rather high volume.
Yes, Joker's Wild with all their stuff played really loud, but they beat us.
What did you do after Flash Tuesday?
After Flash Tuesday, I ended up being in the Mojo Buford Blues Band for a while, and that would have been probably May of 70 to July of 70. It was only a couple of months, and the reason why that was short-term lived or short-lived was because Mojo had got a call from Muddy Waters to join him and finish out a tour or do a tour with him, so he had ended up canning his local band here, which would have been Mojo Buford, Lonnie Knight, Dave Himmelbacher, Rick Johnson, and myself. He kind of canned that band and went on with Muddy Waters to do a tour, and I would have too if I was in his shoes. But I remember we played at the Cozy Bar on Plymouth Avenue, and you know, it was a lot of fun playing with Mojo.
Was there a highlight for you playing with Mojo?
I think one funny thing with Mojo is we went to a place called Peacock Alley, which was an all-black bar, and all of a sudden, here I am with him, and all of a sudden he says, "Hang on to my arm and don't move from me." We walked up the stage and talked to the band and stuff like that for a little bit, and then he says, "Hang on to me as we go back." And I was the only white person in the place. So he says, "You know, this ain't kind of allowed down here," but he says, "Hang on to me and it'll be okay." So that's probably my highlight with that.
Anything else you recall about Mojo?
Mojo Buford, he worked with Lazy Bill Lucas a lot, and meeting Lazy Bill Lucas was kind of interesting because he had this thing around him, this little aura, and he came over and took pictures, and he came to probably about two or three of our practices in one of our jobs and took pictures and stuff like that. I liked Lazy Bill. He was a great guy. Okay, it was weird going from Flash Tuesday Hard Rock to Mojo Buford Blues Band, and now all of a sudden we're in with Lexi Johnson doing a country act, which is all country stuff. She wore her country get-ups and stuff like that, and here you got Lexi Johnson, Rick Johnson, Denny Johnson, and Lonnie Knight. Three Johnsons and a Knight playing, you know, country music. It only went on for probably about a month, but she needed a fill-in band, and that's what we did, and it was a lot of fun.
So this was your very first experience playing country music?
Yes, at just jumping in with a band and just playing this stuff.
Yeah, how'd you like it?
Well, at that time, Polka was coming out and Loggins and Messina, all that stuff was hitting. So it was, you know, it was something that was acceptable.
So after the country band, what did you do?
After the country band, there was a band that we'd formed with Chuck Edwards and Tom Hopp, who were out of Danny's Reasons, along with Robbie Belleville, who was out of, I believe, Copperhead, and myself. Had formed this band, a country rock band, we called ourselves back then, and we named ourselves Bazooka. And the reason why that is we were sitting around one day trying to think of a name, and somebody was chewing gum, and the wrapper was on the floor, and we saw Bazooka. So that's how the band got its name, Bazooka. And we'd done rock and current and some originals, and that band was only together from September of 70 to December 31st of 70. Like I said, it was Chuck Edwards, Tom Hopp, Robbie Belleville, myself.
What kind of music did Bazooka play?
We did a lot of rock that was out. We did current stuff from Joe Cocker and music that was playing at the time, and we did some originals.
Who wrote the originals?
Tom Hopp and myself had wrote the original songs that we were using at that time. And we'd played like places like Kaufman Union. We did a lot of St. Paul clubs. We did JP's in Lakeville. We played a lot of Crosby, Stills, Nash and things like that. It was one of my first bands where we'd had that really nice harmony blend. And that was probably my high point of that band. The reason why that band broke up is because we were traveling Tom Hopp and Chuck Edwards came out of playing Minneapolis, St. Paul all the time. Jobs in town locally. Now all of a sudden you throw those two guys in a van, a U-Haul van, freezing in November, December, driving all the highways of North Dakota. Dave Anthony booked us in North Dakota, South Dakota, Northern Minnesota. We were freezing all the time. And all of a sudden Tom said, "This is not for me." And he ended up moving to Idaho, some ski resort area out there, and he left the band. And after that, the band changed its name and went on.
Now, I understand there was a Joker's Wild reunion here.
Yes. Actually, after that band broke up, and I think we played our last job on December 31st in Frederick, Wisconsin. I think we did New Year's Eve there.
Now, I understand after Bazooka, there was a Joker's Wild reunion for a while.
Yes, I'd thrown together this band of people that were available to play, and we got along really good and we're playing, and we'd went to a booking agency to see about getting some jobs, and all of a sudden he says, you know, he asked, well, who had everybody been with? And all of a sudden when he heard the name Jokers Wild, he says, well, if you guys call yourself Jokers Wild, I can get you jobs right away, or if you want to wait, you know, on an iffy thing. So I said, no, go ahead, use the name Jokers Wild. We did it, and it was Ron Honeybear Hort, Lorenzo Whitmarsh on lead vocals, Scott Holmstrom on guitar, Robbie Belleville on drums, and myself.
And are you actually playing the old Jokers Wild songs?
No, we just did all the commercial stuff. We did a lot of like Traffic and, you know, Joe Cocker and things like that out there. Lorenzo had a great voice. We did Spooky Tooth and stuff like that. The band was a good band, and we were only together about 3 months.
So after that version of Jokers Wild, what happens next?
Dave Anthony had called me and said that he had connections with a place called Rodney's in mind, which was a new club on the strip across from Eddie Webster's that was going to be opening up. He says, can you get a polished group with really good vocals and really good R&B stuff to put together for that place? And he had mentioned that while I was in the Jokers Wild Reunite band that was previously going. We needed a name, so we ended up getting the name Carry On, and that was R&B and funk and current music. And we did that from March of 71 till April of 71. It only lasted about 6 weeks. And that was Chuck Edwards, Jimmy Lawrence from Dave Brady and the Stars, Robbie Belleville, Steve Larson from Danny's Reasons, and myself. And we had opened up the club Rodney's in Mind. We did like 4 and 5 part harmonies. It was a great band. But after we did our 5 weeks at Rodney's in Mind, we couldn't get any work anymore. Dave Anthony was only a booker who did a lot of stuff out of town. And when he sent the picture of the band out there, unfortunately, it came back saying that we can't have bands with black members in it playing here. So Jimmy ended up leaving and went back to some of his friends and played, and Chuck Edwards ended up leaving. And
so David Anthony would send out photos of the band, the club owners.
Out of town,
outside of Minnesota.
Yes, outside of Minneapolis.
Okay, and the club owners would see that the band was mixed race.
Yes.
And they would decline to book the band based on the fact that it was a mixed race band.
Yep. Hard to believe in 1971, but that's the way it was.
And that was in other states as well as outstate Minnesota too?
Yes.
Is that something that you had run into before, or is this the first time?
No, I've ran into it a couple of times.
All right, so after Carry On, what happens?
I'd met Bill Stranloff. Bill Stranloff was at B-Sharp Music, and I told him that I was kind of in between bands, and he was in between bands, and he says, you know what, we ought to get together and do something. So he says, do you know anybody else? And I says, well, I can probably get Bill Swanson and Robbie Belleville. And he says, well, you want to get together at my place? I says, sure. So we ended up the next week at Bill Stranloff's house in the basement. You know, we'd start playing and jamming and stuff like that, and did some songs, and it really clicked really nice. We had great harmonies and did some nice songs. We did a lot of top 40, and that band played from the first part of September. We did a lot of jobs through March, and we played all the way up until December 31st, when all of a sudden Bill Stranloff said that he wanted to leave the band to go back to school for electronics. So the band did well. We played well. One bad thing we had is Marsh booked us in Chicago at Shag's Pub. And we got down there, we were playing. And on the second night, somebody came up and says, aren't you going to play your hit record? And we went, what's that? We never knew that there was another band out there with the name Bullet that had a record out at the time.
That was White Lies and Her Blue Eyes?
That's probably the name of it. But we didn't do the song, and when they found out we weren't the band, they said, we thought when we booked it, we were booking that band. And so they let us go, and I remember we had to pack up, and after playing there from 9 until 2 in the morning for 2 nights, we did not get paid. We got sent back to Minneapolis.
What do you recall about Bill Stranloff's mother?
Bill Stranloff's mother was great. When we practiced at their house, she used to always like to bake cookies and little muffins and stuff like that and bring us down. Oh, you got to take a break, boys. You got to take a break, boys. And we'd always have like our little Cokes and Pepsis down there, and she'd bring down these little treats all the time. She was just great. She was a really neat lady.
All right, so after Bullet, what happens next?
After Bullet, Dave Anthony had come to me, I remember, in late January of 72, and he said that he wanted to do something for the tubers in Wisconsin because it was such a great business over there, Riverside or River's Edge and all that kind of stuff. They had these where you rent tubes and took them down the Apple River. And he says, do you think you can come up with a song that we can do in the studio and put out as a record and we can sell it over there? So I said, sure. So I ended up writing the song called Tubin' in Somerset. And we went into the studio, I remember, in March of 72. We had funding from the society or the association of tubing over there. And we did this song called Tubing in Somerset.
What studio was it?
That we went to Audiotech with Dan Holmes. Dan Holmes recorded, he was engineered everything. The members in that band in Cookiefoot would have been Chuck Edwards, Lonnie Knight, Robbie Belleville, Bill Swanson, and myself. It wasn't really a band. It was just we needed a name to put on the record when we put it out there. So I remember watching a commercial for Captain Crunch, and it was Captain Cookiefoot was on there. So I took the name Cookiefoot from there, kind of a little steal. But we came up with something that was trying. I was trying to be like kind of cutesy and funny for it, for Tubin' in Somerset. And then the song went over really well. I remember we had a big party there. We invited all the radio stations from Minneapolis and people from Heilecker Brothers and stuff like that, the distributor, to come over there. And we had all these people for this big party over there. And what's really funny is while we're doing this party over there with these people, in comes Charles Kuralt, his van or his big motor home from Charles Kuralt on the road for CBS. So he ended up filming the whole thing and doing it. And he put us on TV with that little spank of success. The record sold pretty well. I think the band only played once. We played a job over at Archie's in Somerset. We did for, after we had that party, we had all the band come over and we played that night. So we did a lot of different covers and stuff like that. But we did do, you know, Tubin' in Somerset a couple of times that night.
So the band actually played live.
The band actually played live. Yes, it did.
So after Cookiefoot, what happens next in your musical career?
Well, we still had a little bit of funding and stuff like that at the recording studio. So I had a bunch of songs that I wanted to record. And at the same time, David Anthony had brought over Johnny Dott, this country performer, country singer, who had been trying to write this song about a man who had a train accident and lost his legs. And he used to be on this little push cart selling pencils and shoelaces on these corners down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So he told me the story about him, and then I wrote the song that week, and then I went into the studio and recorded it with Lonnie and Chuck Edwards, Robbie and Bill Swanson. At the same time we were there, the band Purple Haze was in the studio recording and doing some stuff, and I asked them if they would play bongos and congas in the background of this tracks that I'd laid down. So they agreed to, and I thought it turned out kind of well, put a little bit of different flair to it when I actually took the rough mix and went over to see Johnny Dott and say, here's the song that I'd put together on this person you're talking about. He listened to it and he goes, what the heck is that in the background? We don't have congas and bongos in country music. He goes, why don't you keep the song? It's yours.
What was the name of the song?
Stumpy.
So what did you do?
We sat on it for probably about a year, and I think June of 73, we released it as a single under Denny Johnson. And it went quite well, actually. It was released in 17 states. Dave Anthony brought the record down to Nashville, submitted it to a lot of different record labels down there, and we did get a reply from Brunswick Records. They said, yes, we're interested in putting that out. Could you guys come down and see us? So we went down. It was Dave Anthony, myself, and it might have been somebody else with us, but I'm thinking it was just Dave Anthony, myself, went down there. We had this meeting with Brunswick Records, and they said they really liked the song. Wondered if I had more material to back it up. They says, you know, if we sign this, you're going to need an album right away. So I said, yes, we can put together an album right away and we can do this. And they said, well, it's between you and another performer. So they said, we're going to, you know, hash this over for the next week or so. And we're going to pick one of you two, but one of you is not going to make it. And I was the one that didn't make it. So they signed the other guy, which I still don't even know his name and who he was, but that was my shot to get signed to Brunswick Records and get out there. Also, at the same time Stumpy was being recorded and that, I was in the band Christopher playing the bullpen, and it was Chuck Edwards, Bill Swanson, Robbie Belleville, myself, and all of a sudden I got the opportunity to go to the Institute of Audio Research in New York for audio engineering. And I really wanted that at that time more than I wanted the band. So I ended up going to New York, and I went to the Institute of Audio Research for a while. And when I came back, I had my degree. And like I say, Stumpy came out at that time, late summer, 73. And after that, I just wanted to put together a recording studio and get out there. But that didn't happen. I mean, I didn't have any money or funding. Wes Hain, real good close friend of mine, got me a job at Heilecker Brothers as a truck driver. And I worked that job as a truck driver for about 6 months. And Ira Heilecker one day came up to me and he says, "You're kind of a smart ass guy." He says, "I think you'd be really good in sales." He says, "What do you think if I take you off the truck and put you in the promotions department working with them, and you work with the head shops and try and get out there and increase sales?" I said, "Sure." So that's what I ended up doing. I ended up going in the promotion department, Heilecker Brothers, working with them.
How'd you like that?
I liked it a lot. Like I say, when I started there, I had 26 stores. And when I left there, 9 years later, I had 120-something stores. So
all in Minnesota?
No, we were all over the Midwest.
So you drove around a lot?
No, I did not drive around. I only drove to the local stores in Minneapolis, but I did everything else online, on the phone.
Okay.
I stayed with them 9 years. They were bought out by Hartz Mountain, and they had budget cutbacks, and they let 200 people go on a Friday, and I was one of the 200.
Now, there's another Joker's Wild reunion of sorts, with this time with Lonnie Knight. When did that occur?
That occurred right after the Stumpy thing was going on and wasn't going anywhere. Dave Anthony said Cobblestone Ballroom in Iowa called and said that they had some jobs for Joker's Wild. He said they weren't the same members, and they said, "That's okay. If you can come up with some of them and put together the band, we will book them and have them down here." So Dave Anthony came to me, and I got back to Lonnie, and I says, "Lonnie, should we go down there and do it? I mean, you know, we don't have Bill Gent. We don't have Pete Huber. What do you want to do?" He says, "Well, what do you have?" I says, "Well, I got Chuck Edwards, another lead guitar player, and I got Robbie Belleville." So he says, "Okay." So we got together and we did a couple of practices, and we did a bunch of Jeff Beck stuff and things like that. It kind of clicked off. So we had enough material to get through 4 hours. So we ended up taking the job, and we did that one in Iowa. And I think we did like two jobs after that, and that was the end of that one. So we only ended up, you know, going from September to probably the beginning of October or late September of 72.
Did the band have a strong fan base down there at Cobblestone Ballroom?
We had a huge fan base down there. We could pack the place all the time. And we had a lot of people then that came down that wanted to see us again. And yeah, the job went well.
Okay.
I recorded it that night. I got a few songs from that night.
So what happens after the Joker's Wild reunion?
Okay, the first part of October, Bill Jordan calls me. And he said, "Are you doing anything right now?" And I says, "No." He says, "Do you want to play?" And I says, "Well, yeah." He says, "Well, I got a country rock band." And he says, "Our bass player left." And he says, "If you can fill the shoes, you know, let's do it." And all of a sudden I says, "Okay, when are we rehearsing?" He says, "We don't rehearse. You just come down and play." So luckily I knew how to play guitar to where I could just sit and watch his chord changes, because I didn't know half these songs. I mean, they did a lot of really, really old country, and then they did a lot of newer stuff. So I started playing with them in early October. That was Winterwood, and we had a couple different versions of the band, and that went all the way until 75. Okay, the first version of that band would have been Bill Jordan, Big John Thompson on lead vocals, Gary Erickson, and myself. And then I remember after a while, John wanted to go be a DJ, and Gary wanted to get out of it entirely. So we ended up switching the band out to Winterwood number 2, which would have been Bill Jordan, Bill Swanson, who I grabbed from earlier, who played with me, and he was out of work at the time. So we got together with him, and then Lance Dunkirk, he used to play with a lot of different bands around the city, and myself. And we did that thing, and it went on for, I think we were a house band for a year at the Straw House in Anoka. And the whole thing started at Dirty Flows on Hennepin Avenue in Minneapolis, and went to Hidden Haven and Blaine and East Bethel, Straw House in Anoka, and that's where the band ended up. We played the last year at the Straw House, and not a lot of bands get the opportunity to not move their equipment and just be a band for a year.
Was Dirty Flo an actual person?
Yes, Flo was an actual person, but they just called the bar Dirty Flows to have a little twist to it.